Hi, this is Andrew Conry-Murray with Network Computing. Today my guest is Brian Chess, PhD, founder and chief scientist of Fortify Software. Fortify Software sells tools to help developers find and fix bugs that lead to security problems. Dr. Chess, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Andrew.
So you started this business just a couple of years ago, right?
Right, 2003.
But your customer list already includes big names like eBay, Wells Fargo, Oracle, Goldman Sachs, and so on. What's your secret? Okay, so is it an issue of training and awareness, or?
Well, it's really training and awareness, so that you have a basic notion of what it means to be secure, and then it's about meticulously applying that training and awareness to everything that you do. So let me give you an analogy to spelling. So it's important, if you want people to spell well, then you need to train them. You need to give them rules like I before E except after C. But that doesn't stop them from making spelling mistakes. So it's still useful to give them tools like a spell checker that will apply all of the spelling rules that we can come up with.
Do we get into turf issues, though, with, you know, a security guy and maybe even an IT security guy coming into the developers and saying?
So I'm not sure exactly what you mean by turf issues. So like the security guy comes and tells the developer, I know how to do your job, and now you got to do it my way. And then
sort
the developers
of,
don't necessarily.
Yeah, just who is this guy coming in and telling us that there's a problem with our work, and what does he know about it, and how much more work is this going to make for me?
So I'll tell you, we see this problem all the time. So we're selling tools to help people find security problems. But if they don't want to find security problems, then it doesn't really matter whether they've got good tools or not.
Mm-hmm.
So the number one thing that we like to see when we go and talk to a customer is, do they have the right attitude? And the right attitude is, it's not complete until it's secure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start with that attitude, then when you start looking for tools, you're looking for tools to make you more efficient. The wrong attitude is, I want to push a button and make it secure.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't matter what the scenario is, you're never going to find a case where you can get push button security.
But one of there's a couple of common complaints I've heard, though, with software security analysis tools, and that's that they can generate false positives, and that they can also, you know, slow down the whole application development lifecycle because you're just adding another step in. So how does that come into play?
So those, I'd say those complaints are absolutely hallmarks of someone who's looking for that. I want to push a button and then poof, I want my code to be secure.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's your attitude, then any amount of false positives and any amount of slowing down of the process is going to be unacceptable. However, if you take the case that you decided, I want my code to be secure, and now how can I do that? Well, I could sit down and I could start reading through it line by line, but that's going to take a really long time. That's going to be really inefficient. So if you look at the tools we have today, they're far from perfect, but they're way, way better than not having any tools at all.
When you talk about attaching bonuses to secure code, is that, you know, I guess I'm looking at questions of motivation. Do you have to take those kind of steps maybe to have a successful change of attitude?
I like to think of developers as being the ultimate optimizers,
mm-hmm.
right? So if, for instance, you tell them that security is optional, then they're going to optimize it out of their process.
Mm-hmm.
So the real message that you've got to get to the developers is that you have to make it secure. You're not done until the code is secure. And once you've got that message through, then they'll start optimizing along those lines. Of course, their tendency is to, and I think this is part of human nature, is that they want to operate under the same assumptions they were operating under yesterday and last year and a decade ago. And the fact is that the security landscape has changed, and now what a lot of software developers do is security relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got to come around to that, and if you've got to put their bonuses on the line to do it, then so be it.
So how does a company or developers decide when something is secure enough, because it's, you know, not feasible to chase down and get rid of every potential bug or flaw in an application? So how do you know when something's ready to go?
That's a really good point. So when I was in graduate school, one of the guys on my committee, Matt Bishop, he's a professor at University of California at Davis.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about security as a wall, and you can have a wall that looks more like a curb, or you can have a wall that looks more like a chain link fence, or you can build the Great Wall of China. And it doesn't matter how high a wall you build, there's always some way to get over the wall. So
mm-hmm.
security is never perfect. It's a question of what do you need to be secure against. And so when you think about, well, okay, what do I need to be secure against? I think the best thing you can do is take a look at, historically speaking, how have systems been taken down?
Mm-hmm.
And that changes over time as we get more as we move further and further into the arms race that we have with the bad guys. So what do you do in order to make sure that your systems are secure? And the thing I tell people is, look at your history. Look at the history of systems like the systems that you're building. We're starting to get a pretty good history of what do you need to do in order to make a website secure, for example. So you can go out and you can look at what are the kind of common problems that lead to insecurity in websites. Make sure you're defending yourself against those before you do anything else.
Can you give me a sense, are there specific kinds or classes of attacks that your customers are worried about these days?
Well, let's see. If you asked me that question a couple of years ago, I would say SQL injection was the big problem for people who were building websites,
mm-hmm.
because you can take a regular web page, and then in the hands of the bad guy, it can deliver any information out of the database back to the attacker, potentially even deliver administrative access to the database back to the attacker. People are beginning to get that under control, and the one that's really scary right now is cross-site scripting.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why cross-site scripting, I guess I should mention what somebody can do with cross-site scripting first, though. So cross-site scripting used to be about defacing people's websites. So you could have Barney the dinosaur appear on somebody's website, and haha, isn't that funny? And these days, it's more about stealing credentials and impersonating users. So if you've got a cross-site scripting vulnerability on your website, someone can perform phishing attacks directly off of your URL. And any of those wonderful tools or browser plugins that tries to tell a user when you're at a bad guy's website won't work, because you can phish PayPal right off of the PayPal website.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty scary stuff. So. The problem with cross-site scripting, though, is that a lot of the frameworks that we've built in order to build websites don't make it very easy to prevent cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. So a lot of times, the obvious thing, the easy way to write a piece of code, results in a cross-site scripting vulnerability. And that means that there are a lot of vulnerabilities out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, in terms of a perennial plague-like issue, cross-site scripting is probably the one these days on the web.
Okay.
For people who are writing code in languages like C and C++, the problem for the last 10 years and the continuing problem is buffer overflows.
Okay.
And all sorts of memory corrupting attacks. And again, just like where web frameworks make it easy to write cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, C and C++ makes it easy to write buffer overflow vulnerabilities. And that's just the way those languages were designed.
You'd mentioned in talking about cross-site scripting that the easy way to get the web page written results in vulnerabilities. Does security make applications less efficient? Or, to put it another way, is secure code also efficient code? Is there some kind of correlation between making code secure, but also maybe more or less efficient?
Imagine a physical world where we didn't have to worry about security.
Mm-hmm.
Like we wouldn't need car keys, for example. We wouldn't need house keys. We might not even need doors in some places, right? I guess what I'm trying to say is that the notion of separating security from code just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
You could write your application so that it performed some functions but wasn't secure,
mm-hmm.
but you wouldn't be done writing your application. Just like you can't really make a car and call it done before it's got an ignition with a key that goes into it. So saying that security causes or perhaps impedes efficiency isn't a realistic view.
Okay. I guess I was thinking of the example in the network security world where you can encrypt a database, but then you're going to add delay to every transaction that you're conducting. Or you can protect documents with digital rights management, but then you potentially impede, users getting access or partners getting access. And so security becomes a barrier. Does that ever happen with software as well?
So a lot of times people talk about security being at odds with usability.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were talking about security at odds with performance, or security at odds with with you getting the information to the people who are supposed to have access to it. And I'd say that there's some truth to that, but I guess the counter to that is not, well, could we do without the security?
Right.
We've got to find the right compromises between the amount of security and the way that we go about making something secure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's unfair to think about that in terms of make it secure or not.
Have you ever run into a customer that had generally secure code, before you guys came along?
So we see a great range of systems. So we see some people who clearly have not thought about security at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we see some people who have done years of manual audits on their code. And generally speaking, when they've been paying attention to security for a while, their code shows it. And we rarely, if ever, come across a code base where we can't make some helpful suggestions as to how it could be made more secure. And I'll tell you the interesting thing here is that the people who've been thinking about security for a while, and generally the state of their system is pretty good, they actually are more likely to take us up on our advice for how can we add a little bit of extra security to their systems.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the people who have radically insecure systems are more interested in us trying to prove that there's anything wrong at all. So I would say in 2006, we still live in a world where not everyone has woken up to security being a software problem.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting there, and I'll tell you, the customers that I talked to this year are much more informed and much more on the ball than the customers I was talking to 2 years ago.
And in working with customers, have you ever seen anything that really scared you?
I don't want to name any names here.
Of course.
But I have changed my online habits based on code that I've seen. Yes.
Really? In what way? in what way?
I have changed passwords. So basically, my internal model for what sites I think are secure and what practices that I think are good have made me basically have a set of passwords that I use for sites if they're secure, and then I've got a different set of passwords and credentials and ways of interacting with sites that I think are less secure. So, this is one of the amazing things about being a security guy. You think, once you put your security hat on, you get paranoid, and maybe you have sort of a glasses half empty view of the world, and you can still go in and find things that are scary and surprising. And I'd say this happens to me on about an annual basis, where I find out, I get to take the sheet off of and look at the inner workings of some system or some site, and it really blows my hair back. So. apparently this is something I'm just not going to get over.
Right. Maybe you could set up a little business on the side, letting friends and close relations know what to avoid and what's okay. So what does a company do when they deploy some kind of security analysis software and it tells them that they've got flaws in commercial applications, in applications that are generating revenue right now? Because they can't just, shut the shop down and start over.
So that's a good point. So, we as a community know how to build really high-quality, reliable, secure software. And the problem is that it's just very, very expensive. So another way to kind of come at this whole security problem is that we're trying to meet our security goals while continuing to meet all of our other goals related to performance, related to time to market, related to feature set. And so you've got to find some way where you can start building security into the software that you produce without sacrificing on any of those other fronts.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that you can do is you can say, well, let me take a combination of problems that I know I have in my code and visibility or importance of different systems and focus my efforts on making sure that the most visible or the most important systems are the ones that I give attention to first. That's actually a really good reason to have source code analysis tools around that can give you metrics about what's in different code bodies that you might have floating around in your organization. But generally speaking, I would say that if you're going to wait 2 years to deploy whatever the next major version of the software is, that's too long to wait if you find out you've got major security problems today. And that's actually part of what motivated us to do more than just source code analysis and to actually help people with things like application defense, where we're trying to protect sites that are up and running.
How are bad guys attacking applications, and where are they getting all their knowledge and information?
I guess the main thing that I see bad guys doing is that they look for the low-hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a conscious effort on the part of the bad guys, or if that's just the way it works out, where the next place they find the problems are and the next easiest place to find the problems. So, for instance, when Microsoft Windows starts to improve its security and it's hard to break into, then the bad guys are thinking, what other software is widely deployed and has security problems that I could go after? Oh, hey, look, the antivirus guys, they're exposed to the outside world because they scan everything that comes in. And, hey, if they've got vulnerabilities, I could break into a lot of systems with that. What do you know? They do have a lot of vulnerabilities. Okay, well, then the next year or two is about finding vulnerabilities in antivirus software. So I think that this is a never-ending arms race, and that we can always expect that the bad guys are going to go after wherever the low-hanging fruit is.
Mm-hmm. But we've also seen kind of an escalation where you talked about the operating system and then like an antivirus or going after a browser. But now there's been some recent news of attacks against things like device drivers, and that's pretty detailed and pretty difficult.
Have got some good brain power on their side.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't expect that this is going to stop at any particular point. I think what we'll find is that this arms race will continue, and we will be worrying about more and more exacting and detailed information about systems and what systems are comprised of. And we won't get to the end of it any more than we've gotten to the end of how to protect the lock on a safe.
Mm-hmm.
That there's still an arms race that goes on there, and we'll always have an arms race over software security too.
Your technical advisory board is a real who's who of academic security researchers and software experts. I'm wondering who you think is doing interesting work among independent researchers or underground security researchers.
You know, I think we put together a really good technical advisory board because there was this desire in the academic research community, and just a real strong interest in 2003 in how can people contribute to making applications more secure. And so that's how we sort of pulled off, you know, getting Avi Rubin and Bill Joy and David Wagner to sit on our advisory board. But there are a lot of people out there who are doing good work. We're mostly in the white hat world, so we don't so much deal with independent researchers who are trying to develop exploits or things like that. But there are a couple of projects out there that I think are doing really good and interesting things related to helping people make software more secure. Let's see, like the OWASP project, the Open Web Application Security Project, is doing, I think, really good stuff. They're probably best known for the OWASP top 10 list of application vulnerabilities, but they've done a lot of other really good stuff too. They've got the OWASP Guide, which is a guide to secure coding that's pretty popular. They've also got their Honeycomb project that Fortify just donated quite a bit of material to. And the Honeycomb project is about trying to classify and name all sorts of attacks and vulnerabilities and countermeasures and really create a lexicon for all of the things that we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what Fortify donated to that was a collection of vulnerability descriptions. So we took about 120 categories of vulnerabilities where we'd written up what is the vulnerability and given some sample code and explained what do you need to do in order to avoid it or prevent it. And we had all that information on the web already at vulncat.fortifysoftware.com. But we handed it all over to the OWASP Honeycomb project so they could build it into part of the bigger picture. And they've done some really good stuff with it.
Great.
So I would say OWASP is going strong. And then the other one, and OWASP has been around for a while. This next one hasn't been around for too long, and that is securitymetrics.org.
Okay.
If you think this whole problem of trying to make something secure is hard, then try the problem of trying to measure the result. That is really, really super hard. But if you're serious about trying to get security right, at some point you've got to start making some measurements. And that's what the security metrics guys are about. And so I like the securitymetrics.org folks a lot too.
I'm wondering about people like Greg Hoagland and others who are doing some pretty detailed research on things like rootkits and having it all be pretty open and out there for people who, may or may not have strong moral values.
So are you kind of hinting at the is it better to disclose what's going on so that that everyone, all the white hats, can take advantage of the information, even though we might be feeding information to the black hats?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, where do you come down on that debate, which has been going on for ages?
Well, for example, if you look at the Sony DRM debacle, when was that? That was around Christmas time, and Ed Felton's blog, Freedom to Tinker.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the work that they did there was phenomenal, and they were explaining how rootkits work and how Sony had basically rooted your box with information on that CD. And of course, that might be valuable to somebody who would be interested in developing a rootkit themselves. But more importantly, I think it moved the word rootkit into the public eye, and it got a lot of people interested in, well, am I sacrificing my privacy in order to listen to some music? And I think that was, by and large, a positive experience for our society and for the security community. And so, as usual, the side that I come down on here is the side of disclosure, which is we're better off talking about problems than we are trying to hush them up.
Bounties for exploitable vulnerabilities.
I think that's pretty silly, quite honestly.
What is that?
I know where they're coming from, which is we live in an age where it's pretty easy to monetize a vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And so where they're going is well, if you can monetize a vulnerability, then why don't we just have a market for vulnerabilities, and we can just pay you for your information, and that's how the world works anyway, isn't it? And I think that's sort of like saying that a speeding ticket is sort of like paying a few hundred dollars in order to have the privilege to drive really fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's the wrong way to view it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because there is a market out there for vulnerabilities doesn't mean that you should be paying people in order to develop exploits. So,
but isn't that a form of disclosure? Encouraging disclosure?
I think it's encouragement in the wrong sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got to tell you, I don't think that paying for vulnerabilities is really going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that there will always be some of it going on, but I don't imagine that this is going to be a long-term and important sort of endeavor in the public commercial market. So I think it always will go on. Vulnerabilities always will have some monetary value, but I think this is a short-term phenomenon that we're looking at, where people pay bounties for vulnerabilities.
You think because it's not going to yield any significant advantage for the payee?
Exactly.
Or the payer, I'm sorry.
The payee may find out that they can make more money elsewhere too. So I would say that's a hard open market to set your prices in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to last.
So if we ever get to the point where developers can use tools like yours to put out 100% secure software, what does that mean for the rest of the security industry?
Well, I'll tell you, the kinds of problems that we were talking about earlier with, you know, buffer overflows and cross-site scripting problems and SQL injection,
mm-hmm.
these are all pretty basic stuff, really.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still working on getting the basic stuff right. So I think it's going to be a while before we're at the point where we ought to be, which is that you can expect that when you buy a piece of software or you write a piece of software, that all of the basics are going to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think this will always be an arms race. So once we get all of the basic stuff right, then the attackers will start going after more advanced stuff, and we'll have to worry about more advanced stuff.
Okay.
I'll tell you sort of where I think it all heads towards, and that is things that are not necessarily derived from technical attacks. So if you want to launch a cross-site scripting attack or a SQL injection attack, you've got to know what SQL is.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to know what JavaScript is if you're interested in cross-site scripting. That's all pretty technical stuff. If you take out all of the technical attack stuff, then you start getting into the realm of things that look a little bit more like fraud. And fraud is a really, well, fraud's been going on for a long, long time, and I don't think there's any hope that we're going to end fraud anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
But we can build systems that are more or less susceptible to fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think more and more of security work, if we do our jobs well, will be aimed at fraud.
Okay. So more toward social engineering, the human element, that kind of thing?
So for instance, if I'm writing some software that's going to work in a call center,
mm-hmm.
then in order to identify a customer, do I have to be exposed to their social security number every time I pull up their customer record?
Right.
Because if I do, then as the author of that software, I'm encouraging those call center operators to engage in fraud because
mm-hmm.
I'm showing them private data that maybe isn't necessary. As they do their job every day, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
I would say that we're a long way away from having that be our primary concern. But if we can take care of all of these technical details, then we can start spending our time more on ways that we could discourage fraud when we build systems.
And how do you go about making sure that your own software is secure and doesn't have flaws? Do you eat your own dog food?
we certainly do. I'll tell you, I said earlier, we sell to a lot of security teams.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does a security team do when they get some new piece of software? They try to break it.
Right.
So we found out very early on that our software was going to be attacked, and it was going to be attacked by our customers who
mm-hmm.
were trying to decide whether we knew what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have a secure development process that we go through where before we release our software, we try to make sure that we think it's going to pass the muster with our customers who are going to scrutinize it. And one of the ways they're going to scrutinize it is trying to decide whether it's secure. So it's certainly important for us to make sure that we don't have the kinds of problems that we preach about people trying to remove.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the way we do that is actually very similar to the way that we recommend other people do it. That is, when we're defining our requirements, we start by defining, you know, what are our security objectives? Where do we see potential problems? And then we do a number of reviews through the development process.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, our developers are probably a little more up on security issues than developers in other realms. But, you know, that doesn't solve the problem for us. We still have to make sure that we focus on security in the products that we make.
Have you ever run into a security team at a customer who really kind of knocked your socks off, and they came back to you with stuff that made you say, "Ooh, nice work, guys"?
Oh, we run into good security teams all the time,
mm-hmm.
and I'll tell you let's see. So actually, one of my favorite security vulnerabilities that people found in Fortify software was because they had been burned by the same vulnerability a couple of years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very rarefied attack, But it was real, and I'm afraid that if I you know, this isn't going to be very useful to you, because if I give you any more details, it's going to be a little too revealing about the customer.
Okay.
But they taught us some really interesting stuff about ways to attack our software that we hadn't considered yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we learned quite a bit from that interaction with that customer, and that's not uncommon for us to run into people who've got really good ideas about how to make things secure and who want our help with it. And like I said at the beginning of our conversation, a lot of times that leads to better products from us. So I think that's one of the things we've done a good job at is listening to our customers.
Do they ever submit a bill for the development work they put into it for you?
They ought to be negotiating for a discount for next time around. I'm not sure if they've connected all the dots yet.
Okay. Well, maybe this will help them along. Okay, that's all my questions.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, no worries. It's been really good.
Well,
so.
Good to hear it.